From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. As the Biden administration navigates roadblocks in Congress over infrastructure and voting rights, it's taking on another major issue, and that's gun violence. Homicides were up 30% last year in big cities, according to the White House, a reality that has resurfaced in the debate among Democrats about how to address violent crime while still pursuing police reform. Let's bring in NPR White House correspondent Aisha Roscoe. Hi, Aisha.
Hello.
The White House is calling this a comprehensive strategy to combat gun violence and other violent crime. It sounds ambitious. What are they proposing?
So they're saying that they're going to crack down on gun sellers who break federal laws. There's going to be a zero tolerance policy for that. They're also talking about having additional support for local law enforcement in case crime increases during the summer, investing in community violence intervention programs, and expanding summer employment services, particularly for teens and young adults, because that can lead to crime if they don't have anything to do. And also helping those people who have been in prison and have records to help them to be able to thrive when they come back into their communities, to find jobs and housing. Part of the way that they're going to do this is by the Treasury Department is saying that funds that were allotted for COVID relief, if there are any left over, that they can now be used to hire additional police officers and pay overtime in communities that feel like they need it, as well as assist in funding employment opportunities for young people.
Okay. We know that Biden has had a long history with this issue. And of course, it's a major problem in our country. But why is it the administration taking on this problem now? There has been talk that Democrats are trying to get ahead of Republicans who might campaign in next year's midterms by calling for law and order.
It is an issue that has been politically effective in the past, especially against Democrats, to paint them as so-called soft on crime, not doing enough to get crime in order. And, you know, to remember, the law and order theme was something that worked, particularly for Republicans, going back through the decades. This is a different day, though. And so it seems like what the administration is trying to do is to walk this line where they are responsive to concerns about crime, but without turning to this very heavy-handed response to crime that has led to, in the past, to mass incarceration.
To your point, one of President Biden's signature achievements as a senator was the 1994 crime bill that temporarily banned assault weapons, as you mentioned, but it also increased funding for police and prisons. The approach to the White House is outlining today is very different, but I want to know, many Democrats and gun control advocates want more action. What kind of pressure is the president under on this?
Well, the president is facing pressure to get something done and also not to just act in response to mass shootings, those huge events that we'll see on TV where, 10 people got killed. What they are saying is a lot of these groups, especially grassroots groups, people of color, and my colleague Juana Summers has done reporting on this, is that they want the White House to pay more attention to how this is affecting communities, particularly communities of color, that are having these shootings, that are dealing with crime, that are dealing with these increases in homicide. They want this to be an issue that doesn't just get attention when there's a mass shooting, but that is getting attention for people who are trying to deal with safety in their homes and in their communities. And so they want these issues of guns to be dealt with. The problem, of course, is that this is a very tough issue, and to get the support that is needed to get something through Congress is very difficult. They have taken some steps as far as executive orders to deal with some parts of this, but this is not an issue that can be solved overnight.
Yes, a lot to report on here. Thank you so much for your reporting on this. That's NPR White House correspondent Aisha Roscoe. Thank you.
Thank you.
Residents of New York City are still waiting to see who won yesterday's mayoral election, but voters in Buffalo, New York, have a pretty good idea who will be leading that city. Community activist and self-described socialist India Walton delivered a major upset in New York's second-largest city. Walton appears to have beaten the four-term incumbent mayor Byron Brown in the Democratic primary. Her supporters were gathering last night at a nightclub when Walton stepped outside to make an important call.
Molly, I'm the mayor of Buffalo. Well, not January, but yeah.
Mayor Brown has not conceded yet, but unofficial results show Walton comfortably in the lead. Let's bring in John Campbell. He's New York team editor for the USA Today Network. John, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, today the Buffalo News says that this may rank as the most historic upset in the city's political history. What exactly happened in this election?
Well, Byron Brown was a firmly entrenched four-term incumbent. He was seeking a fifth term. He rarely had a serious challenge. And then along came a woman named India Walton, who is a nurse, a community organizer. She ran a community land trust that sought to redevelop blighted properties. And she ran a very spirited campaign that very obviously resonated with the Democrats in the city of Buffalo. And she was able to win against Byron Brown in the Democratic primary in a race that essentially decides the mayor's race. There is no Republican candidate. Byron Brown doesn't have an ability to run on another line in November. So she essentially won the mayor's race last night, barring something unforeseen between now and November.
And I think it's fair to say that compared to the mayor's name recognition, most people had never heard of India Walton at the start of her campaign just a couple of months ago. So how did she do it? What was her platform?
Her platform was one of people first, right? She over and over made the case that her campaign is about people and Byron Brown is about developers and the rich, et cetera, et cetera. And that is one. That's a platform that resonated with a lot of people on the left plank in New York and in Buffalo in particular. She had support from the Working Families Party, which is an influential third party in New York that is left-leaning and pushes that campaign message in all the campaigns that it runs. She had support from Democratic Socialists of America, which is the largest socialist organization in New York. And it is a message that resonated with a good amount of Buffalo Democrats. She got roughly 10,000 votes, 11,000 votes, about 1,500 more than Byron Brown. And with about 1,500 absentee ballots out, that's essentially an impossible margin to overcome.
Well, last night, a reporter asked Walton if she was, in fact, a socialist, and this was her answer.
Oh, absolutely. The entire intent of this campaign is to draw down power and resources to the ground level and to the hands of the people.
Interesting that she is not shying away at all from that political identity. What does that tell you about politics in Buffalo?
Yeah, I think the way to describe it is unabashed. It talks a lot about the politics in Buffalo, but also the Democratic Party. I mean, socialism is more and more becoming an acceptable platform for the, if not preferred platform, for the left flank of the Democratic Party. And in a Democratic primary where you get many on that the left and far left of the party who come out to vote, that's an effective platform. I mean, the city of Buffalo is a heavily Democratic city. But on the other hand, you know, the socialist angle was more of a national angle and a regional angle. You know, it wasn't one that was highly touted in the local politics of the election. And really, the local politics are what matters.
Well, she is likely to win the general election in November because, as you say, there is no Republican opposition. She will be the city's first socialist mayor, and she will also be the first woman to lead the city of Buffalo. What kind of job is ahead of her?
Well, the city of Buffalo is one that has gotten some credit for revitalization in recent years. And you see that a lot in the downtown area. You've seen a lot of construction and development, but it's also a city of immense poverty in a lot of areas of the city. And there is a clearly a divide between the people who are well-to-do in Buffalo and the people who are struggling in Buffalo. And that is a message that she pushed. You know, she's going to face a lot of pressure to deliver for the people in Buffalo that are struggling. And there are a lot of them. There is a lot of poverty in the city of Buffalo, as well as upstate cities across New York. So she'll face pressure to deliver on it.
John Campbell, New York team editor for the USA Today Network. Thank you so much.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Summer is upon us now, and lawmakers in Washington, D.C. are cranking up the heat. Democrats were thwarted this week in their efforts to get an expansive voting rights bill through the Senate. Republicans wanted nothing to do with it. Our political strategists join us now. Alice Stewart is our Republican, and Bill Press is the Democrat. Welcome to you both.
Hi,
Thank
Peter.
Thank you, Peter.
Bill, first you. Last night, in this strictly party-line vote, the Senate rejected moving forward on the voting rights bill, called for a national election reforms such as automatic voter registration, at least 15 days of early voting, and Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said this after it failed to get any Republican support.
The fight to protect voting rights is not over, by no means. In the fight for voting rights, this vote was the starting gun, not the finish line.
So in this political climate, in this divided Congress, I actually don't understand exactly what Chuck Schumer means when he says that this is the starting gun and not the finish line, Bill.
Well, I think we have to be honest about what really happened here yesterday. I think that Chuck Schumer laid a trap and Mitch McConnell and Republicans walked right into it. And the reason I say that, Peter, is that this was not really a vote to pass this big vote, S1, this big Voting Rights Act, which everybody knew was going to fail. I think the goals were twofold. One was to show that voter suppression is front and center part of the Republican agenda, to which I would say mission accomplished. Republicans weren't even willing to debate the issue or to suggest compromises or modifications to any bill, number one. Number two, the goal was really to prove that the Republicans are basically against everything. They're just obstructionists. There was not one Republican vote for the stimulus, not one Republican vote to create the January 6th commission. Now, not one Republican vote for voting rights of all things. So I think this is a setup for getting rid of the filibuster. And I think the point was made that that's the only way to move forward with anything.
Okay, let's keep the powder dry on the filibuster for just a second. Alice, I want to ask you, the Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell basically said there was no need for this bill. Let's listen to him.
There's nothing broken around the country. The system upheld very well during intense stress. There's no rational basis for federalizing this election. Therefore, there's no point in having...
So, Alice, I mean, what do you think? Did Republicans walk into a trap, or is it something different?
No, the bottom line of what happened yesterday was Republicans standing up and saying, no, we're not going to federalize our election process. As everyone knows, our elections are run on a state level and local level, and the laws that govern our election process need to be handled and adapted and crafted at the state level. And what we saw here with S1 is the Democrats' attempt to federalize elections and give too much power to the Federal Election Commission and using this as a partisan tool with regard to the election process. We should not have that. And look, don't be mistaken by Manchin's vote in favor of moving the debate forward, because I don't think he would have ever voted for this measure when it got right down to it. Because the irony here is that one of the key components, a negotiating tool, was allowing voter ID. For years, Democrats have said voter ID shouldn't be a part of the process. It is racist, and it is part of voter suppression. Well, the irony is now Democrats are fine with voter ID because it, in this case, it furthers their agenda for federalizing election. And Republicans said that's not going to happen.
Bill, I know you want to answer that. And actually, I want to ask you about voter ID. But first, Alice, I need to go back to something that you said. And I want to push you on this because in the past, you've criticized Republicans in your party who've questioned the validity of the 2020 election. And let's be honest. I mean, really, that's fundamentally why we're here having this debate. It's not really about whether or not it should be the states or federal, you know, overseeing these elections, right? I mean, this is because Republicans were claiming that the election was stolen, and you know that's not true.
It's not true. We had free and fair elections in 2020, just like we did in 2016. There was not widespread voter fraud in 2020. I've said that from the moment the election was called until now, and I think that's of critical importance. But the key is it's what we're doing in many of these instances across the country is solidifying voter integrity, making sure we have one person, one vote. And that's the goal here. This is not about voter suppression. This is about election integrity. And that's what election officials are doing across the country.
Okay, Bill, I'm going to let you jump in. I'm sure you have plenty to say here. But what about this issue of voter ID? Stacey Abrams and Barack Obama are both praising this compromise. Joe Manchin saying that, yes, we can have some form of voter ID. Democrats are getting behind this. That's a big change, first of all.
Well, first of all, I have to say fact. Okay, it's important to stick to the facts. The fact is Joe Manchin had his own alternative, which Stacey Abrams, as you point out, Peter, and former President Barack Obama both supported. I think that could have gotten through, again, the Senate, maybe. But Republicans voted, every last one of them, not to allow debate on this issue. That debate could have led to adoption of Joe Manchin's plan, whatever, as good as it is, right? It was not allowed because Republicans filibustered it. And so they can't have it both ways. They can't say Joe Manchin's got the answer and then do not allow debate on Joe Manchin's issue. As for the voter ID, you know, the Democratic Party position has always been that requiring a photo ID does disenfranchise millions of Americans. So there should be some alternative. And again, fact, all this bill did that was never debated would have said that states have to provide, allow an alternative if people don't have a photo ID, which I think is a very reasonable measure. And finally, I just want to point out, this the federalize the elections, that's a Republican talking point, which is simply not true about this proposed legislation, which, again, will never be debated on the floor of the Senate. All it did was saying that states have to have certain standards. They can't ban vote by mail. They can't ban early voting. They can't ban Sunday morning voting. After that, they can do whatever the hell they want, but they have to at least make it possible for everybody to vote.
Okay. I asked you to keep the powder dry on the issue of the filibuster. Let's light the fuse.
Okay,
just respond, please, Alice.
Look, I think the filibuster is an important component here. The 60-vote threshold to move debate forward, it's an important rule to forge bipartisanship in the Senate. And it's important that your position on this custom shouldn't change whether you're in the minority or the majority. It should be the same. And the irony that Democrats now want to do away with the filibuster because of their inability to get bipartisanship on their legislation is rich. They haven't been able to do it on COVID relief, on infrastructure, on this important voting process. And they cannot change the rules and the customs of the U.S. Senate just because they're not able to seek bipartisanship. And Kristen Sinema said it best. A Democratic senator from Arizona says they have more to lose than to gain by ending the filibuster. And that's important to keep in mind.
Bill, I brought that up on the program yesterday. Sinema made an interesting point. She's like, look, if you do this, if you get rid of the filibuster, as soon as you lose power, the Republicans are just going to erase everything that the Democrats have done. And isn't there truth to that? I mean, that's, I keep coming back to that idea because I think, you know, it's a valid question, a valid point.
No, there's no truth to it at all. Kristen Sinema is dead wrong about the filibuster.
You don't think so. McConnell said he would do that nuclear option.
First of all, let's be clear. The filibuster is not in the Constitution, right? It's a Senate rule. It was adopted by Southern senators in order to block civil rights legislation. It is the tyranny of the minority today. I agree with Alice on this, that the Republicans and the Democrats should have a consistent position on the filibuster from beginning to end, and that position, in my opinion, should be no. It's against it. It is wrong. And particularly the way it's used today. Even those Southern senators use a filibuster to prevent a vote on the legislation, right, that they did not want. But today it is used to prevent even a debate, to prevent a vote, to prevent any attempt at compromise. It's the gate. They won't even allow open the gate to the Senate floor. That's an abuse of the filibuster. I think it's important to either kill it or at least fix it, make people stand up and debate, which they used to have to do, and lower it from 60 to 55. That would be a good start.
A friendly reminder, Alice, to my friend Bill, is that Democrats use filibuster as recently as last year with regard to COVID relief and police reform.
Alice,
so it's been used.
Alice, I think they were wrong to do so. I hope I'm very clear on that. I don't care if it's Republicans or Democrats. I think the filibuster is undemocratic and is the tyranny of the minority.
Well, thank you. I mean, good debate, I think. And Alice, we have just a couple seconds here. I just want to note something that I've noticed on your Twitter feed recently, and that is that you went to the Grand Canyon last week, hiked in the Grand Canyon. It was, like, ungodly hot. I don't know how you did that or why you did that, but it was impressive. You can take the heat in politics, and you can take the actual heat as well. So, well done. Bill, what are you going to do now?
I'm going to the beach as soon as we're finished here. I'm up at the beach in Rhode Island. The ocean is 62. It's not as hot as it was in the Grand Canyon, but I'll be diving in.
If you get a chance to go to the Grand Canyon, go ahead.
All right, Bill Press and Alice Stewart, our Republican and Democratic strategists. Thank you so much, as always.
Thanks, Peter.
I'm Gregory Warner, host of NPR's Rough Translation. The military helped launch Silicon Valley, but now they're kind of on the outs.
You're surprised that you look at me and say, no, that's not possible. Yes, it is.
And so it just dawned, this is just not going anywhere.
Stories of communication and miscommunication each week on Homefront from Rough Translation.
You've likely noticed a growing number of closed storefronts where you live. Restaurants have had a tough year. And even those that have managed to stay open are still having trouble. They're feeling the squeeze of higher prices, and we, the customer, are starting to see higher bills. Joining us to talk about all of this is Michael Regan, senior editor for Bloomberg News. Hey, Mike.
Hi, Tanya.
Well, we have been talking about inflation for a while now as the economy kicks into higher speed. But lay out for us the specific problems that restaurants are facing managing their costs right now.
Well, there are two main issues going on. One is rising wages. As you say, the economy is really kicking into high gear now, and that's causing a lot of competition for lower wage employees. And the other thing is that the virus and lockdowns and then the very aggressive reopening at the end of it have caused a lot of bottlenecks in supplies for a variety of products, food being one of them. Starbucks has made headlines for shortages of some ingredients to their drinks. And Tanya, chicken wings, one of my favorites, is another great example. They're the type of thing you eat more at a restaurant or a bar than you'd cook at home. So as the economy reopens, there's a big mismatch in supply and demand that's causing chicken wing prices to go really high. Just as an example, in fact, the chain Wingstop actually now has an offshoot called Thigh Stop because they're able to get chicken thighs a lot more cheaply than wings.
Wow. Okay. Thigh Stop. Okay. let's talk, though, about fast food for a minute. Chains like McDonald's and Taco Bell and Chipotle have fought hard to undercut each other and historically have tried to keep price increases small. What are you seeing in that sector?
So Chipotle made headlines recently by increasing its prices on its menu by as much as 5%. Other fast food chains are trying that or different approaches. For example, Reuters has reported that both McDonald's and KFC they've cut back on the number of value meals they offer. Instead, they're marketing higher priced items on the menu, and that gives them a little more wiggle room in the margins, the profit margins, to absorb these higher prices for their ingredients. So a variety of strategies being employed, Tanya.
Are we paying for it? Are we paying these higher prices?
So if you look at the CPI data, the consumer price index data from the government, prices for food at restaurants actually rose 4% in May from a year earlier. So it is showing up in the government statistics that food prices are rising more than they have traditionally.
Okay, I have just about a minute with you, but Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell said at a congressional hearing yesterday that inflation is higher than expected, but he emphasized that this is temporary. But for businesses having to pay more to hire servers and chefs and stuff like that, is this now a permanent increase in the cost of doing business?
So I think most economists out there agree with Chairman Powell that this hot inflation we're seeing is temporary, but wages tend to be sticky, meaning it's hard to reduce wages once you've raised them. But I think what you might see that is in future years, say 2023, 2024, there may be less raises for restaurant workers, or perhaps none at all, as it, you know, the salaries and wages sort of adjust to a higher sort of baseline because of this.
Mike Regan is senior editor for Bloomberg News. I got to check out ThighStop. Thank you so much for this report.
Thanks, Tanya.
You may have heard this idea that we only use about 10% of our brains. Well, that is 100% false. Our brains are constantly active, reasoning, planning, sensing, and it turns out our brains actually have limits. In fact, our next guests argue our brains may have reached their limits, and it has nothing to do with age. Humans are simply processing a lot more information these days. But there are ways we can use our bodies to help strengthen our mind's ability to hold information. Annie Murphy-Paul writes about this in her new book, The Extended Mind, The Power of Thinking Outside the Brain. She joins us with neuroscientist Peter Reiner, a professor of psychiatry at the University of British Columbia. Welcome to you both.
It's good to be here.
Thanks very much.
For so many of us, myself included, the drive to do more has felt more pronounced during this pandemic. And maybe it's because the lines between home and work are blurred. But Annie, you say we've been putting more demands on our brains for quite a while, over the past quarter century. How so?
That's right. And I think you could even take it back further to the beginning of this, of the previous century, the 20th century, when everyday life started to become more cognitively challenging. The things we had to do in our daily lives became less grounded in physical, concrete things and more about abstract concepts. And that trend just kept getting more and more pronounced over the course of the 20th century. And then, of course, over the last 20 or 25 years, along with the dominance that the internet has assumed in our lives and digital technology has assumed in our lives, that has gone into overdrive. We're not imagining things. We really are being asked to do much more with our brains now than ever before.
Peter, you actually published a study in 2016 that said our brains have reached near full capacity after decades of responding to the stress we've put on them. Why now are our brains saying enough, essentially?
Well, I think it's really just a matter of biology that we've been on this trajectory for quite a number of years. And at some point, you can exercise muscles to a certain degree, but then at some point, you're at the physical capacity of muscles. And I think that it's a reasonable analogy with our brains, that we're at the point where we're using them pretty much at the limits of what they're capable of doing. Although I have to say that there may be some ways to tweak the system, but so far we haven't been able to move that needle very well.
Well, let's get right down to it, though. What does this mean for us as we move through? I mean, if our brains are now at near full capacity, we've always been taught that we have limitless power when it comes to our brains. What are the ramifications of this, Annie?
We're always hearing about how extraordinary the human brain is, how astonishing, how it's the most complex structure in the universe. And then at the same time, we know that our own brains fail us, you know, not infrequently. We can't remember things, or we can't focus or pay attention or stay motivated. And as our culture has become so complex and so demanding, we're really having to reach outside the brain to get things done. We really can't rely on the brain alone. We have to be drawing in what you could call extra neural resources, that is outside the brain resources, to think as well as we need to do.
Like what? Give us an example. What do you mean by that?
The sensations of our bodies, the movements of our bodies, the gestures of our hands, all these things can be drawn into the thinking process. Thinking is actually a kind of full body activity. If you pay attention to the inner cues of the body, and if you utilize its ability to move through space and to complement our verbal expression with the gestures of our hands, we can actually think more intelligently by bringing the body into the picture.
Physical activity, are you also saying that that plays a huge part? You talked about the movement of hands, but does physical activity in other ways also help make up for the limits that we are experiencing in our brains?
It does, Tanya, in a whole variety of ways. I mean, more vigorous activity, which this is the purpose of recess, right? Every teacher knows that students who've had a chance to run and play and get out their physical energy come back to the classroom more attentive, more focused. And yet, you know, again, there's been this emphasis on seat time, on the idea that students should be spending as much time as possible sitting, learning. And that really leaves out the role of physical activity in promoting effective thinking.
So what I'm also hearing from you is that trying to process more information is not the way to do it. For instance, I have 6 books I need to read. You're saying instead of doing that, maybe I should get outside and work out or something.
That it would definitely help if you did that in nature. You know, I write in the book about how the kind of information, the kind of sensory information that we encounter in nature is especially well suited to restoring our attention. You know, we think so much about how to direct our attention and how to spend our attention, but we don't think so much about how to refill the tank. And it turns out that spending time in nature is one of the best ways to do that. So I would definitely encourage a walk or a run outside in nature.
So I'd like to interject one more thing there, which is that remembering what went on in all 6 books is really not what your brain is designed to do. And in fact, going back to this idea of, you know, using your brain wisely, we've come to a place where really the idea of the best use of your brain is not necessarily harnessing all that information and storing it, but knowing how to find it, knowing how to manipulate it, and understanding the concepts that are there. And that is kind of a new thing in the world. Certainly the availability of the vast repository of information on the internet at our fingertips 24/7 allows for just that situation. But we make the mistake of when we try to stuff it all inside our biological brains.
Mm. We try to do too much in our heads in general, I would say. And Tanya, when you're thinking of those 6 books you have to read, I wonder if there's a way that some of that could be downloaded, offloaded from your mind onto, say, post-it notes or a whiteboard. You know, the more you can get the contents of your brain out into physical space where you can move around it, you can move it around when we're talking about post-it notes, you can navigate through it as if it's a physical landscape. Those are human strengths that we can't take advantage of when we keep it all locked inside our head.
What does all this mean? How should we interpret the information that you're sharing with us? I'll start with you, Peter.
I want to say that it's not really all bad news, recognizing that our biological brains are working kind of at their limits, because as Annie's book really lays out in a wonderful way, there is this concept of extending our cognitive abilities outside of our brains and doing some cognitive offloading of perhaps things that are relatively trivial, like remembering a phone number or an address or something like that, that is not a great use of this fantastic 3-pound organ between our ears. And that affords an opportunity that is yet a little bit unrealized, which is that we can do things better. And what we really need is kind of a systematic program to teach children and adults effective ways to manage this cognitive offloading so that our brains are freed up for more interesting tasks that they can really do extremely well, like creativity, analytic thinking, things like that.
I'm really taken by you using the phrase, we can free up our brains. Annie, what's the takeaway you want folks to take from what you're telling us?
Yes, you know, we live in such a brain-bound, such a neurocentric society that's really so focused on the brain. And I think that limits us because we have this idea that the way to think well is just to push harder, you know, to apply some grit or some growth mindset. These are some really popular ideas out there. And as Peter is saying, really our best shot for thinking more intelligently at this point is to reach beyond the brain, to pull in these extra neural resources, which include not only the body, but also the physical spaces in which we learn and work, our relationships with other people, and our devices. And we've cultivated the use of the brain to such an extent that we've really overlooked all the ways that we could be learning to think outside the brain, to use these extra neural resources. And as Peter said, I think we could use a much more systematic and organized approach to cultivating that other way of being smart.
That's science writer Annie Murphy-Paul, author of the new book, The Extended Mind, The Power of Thinking Outside the Brain, and Peter Reiner, a neuroscientist at the University of British Columbia. Thanks to you both.
Oh, thanks for having us on, Tanya.
Thank you
this
very
is great.
Much.
We're marking 50 years since the start of the war on drugs in the U.S. Early on in that war, people who got addicted were treated like criminals. Today, there is growing acceptance that addiction is a treatable disease, but still, shame and discrimination linger. From member station WBUR, we're rebroadcasting this story from Martha Biebinger about one longtime drug user.
Heroin rewired and took control of Will's brain for 17 years, starting in the early 2000s.
Back then, it was if you used drugs, people didn't want anything to do with you. I had lost everything.
His license, car, job, marriage, and home. It happened here on the streets of Lynn, just north of Boston. Will's 56, a former basketball player, and still moves like one. We're only using Will's first name because future landlords or employers might not take him based on the shoplifting and other drug-related crimes he committed so he could buy heroin.
Feeding that addiction, yep, feeding that monster.
One morning, almost 3 years ago, with no money or heroin, Will went into withdrawal. Shaking and vomiting, he dragged himself down the street, hoping to make a deal and feed the monster.
I had some crack and I sold it to some undercover police. That's how I got in trouble. And so that was the game changer right there.
Because instead of prison, Will was sent to a daily probation program called Community Corrections.
This office right here, this is where I went for 18 months.
In this old domed brick building, Will got counseling and other elements of addiction treatment. He had classes on anger management, problem solving, and job training. Massachusetts has 18 such centers. Vin Laurenti, who oversees the program, says it started 25 years ago as a remedy for prison overcrowding.
And at that time, there was a kind of a pivot towards this idea of substance use disorder as a disease rather than merely some kind of a lack of willpower, if you will.
Today, 75 to 80% of people sent to community corrections in Massachusetts have a history of drug use. Since they live at home, the cost is a fraction of incarceration, and only about half the people in this program reoffend as compared to those leaving prison. But Laurenti says the war on drugs still casts a shadow.
Some people might think, oh, well, that's being soft with crime. But if you know somebody that's struggled with substance use disorder, you know that pursuing your recovery is not something that's easy or soft.
Will came out of community corrections trained for a job that helps drug users through that struggle. He's a recovery coach, doing anything he can to keep clients alive and guide those who are ready into treatment.
It's an everyday battle and challenge, but it's gratifying for me.
Will works out of an office at the Lynn Community Health Center. It's piled with donations and supplies for clients who, like Will, have lost everything.
We're looking at t-shirts, jeans, hoodies. This contains condoms.
He gives people still using drugs clean needles, something that's illegal in some places. The health center CEO, Dr. Kiami Mahania, hired his first recovery coaches just a few years ago, paying for them with grants.
It's very recent that people with lived experience are valued as the most important member of the team because of that lived experience. Now it's just, unimaginable to think that we'd be able to do the work without recovery coaches.
Medications are also transforming opioid addiction treatment. There are three commonly used drugs that prevent overdoses and save lives. Two are given in the privacy of a primary care office, just like care for other chronic conditions. Mahania says these meds relieve the symptoms of addiction so that patients can focus on rebuilding their lives.
Compared to 40 years ago, it's amazing. I mean, the difference in landscape that this has done is amazing.
Will is on the oldest of the three medications, methadone. He has to go to a designated methadone clinic to get his dose. Will says he feels dismissed by some people who see him going there or who know he used heroin for many years.
You know, a lot of people are very judgmental. They like to say that person's not going to amount to nothing. If you don't give somebody a chance, how are they going to make it in life?
Will says he's grateful for the people who did take a chance on him and for his church, which he calls the foundation of his 2 years in recovery.
I feel happy about being where I'm at right now, and I just pray to God that I can keep doing this for a while. You know what I mean? The sky's the limit.
Will is tapering off methadone and plans to continue recovery without it by summer's end. He bought a car, and he signed up for classes this fall, more training in addiction recovery, so that he can help others return to healthy, productive lives. For NPR News, I'm Martha Biebinger in Boston.
And tomorrow, as part of our series on the war on drugs, we'll hear how television has influenced the way we think about drugs and addiction in the past 50 years.
I think it was easy for white America to have one point of view about the drug war when it was mostly hitting minority communities. What really changed was the opioid epidemic that began to affect people across all races, and especially white people, and especially people in rural communities.
That's tomorrow on Here and Now. Our show is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.